Thanks for coming. I'm Ann Hafton. This session is labeled accompaniment, and I will talk about accompaniment and the principle of solidarity. But I think we might have, I'm hoping we'll have a little extra time since I didn't build into this week's program, you know, just a plain old Q&A about the occupation and what that is like in the lives of the Palestinian church and the people. So if there's time, I hope we can do a little of that as well. Let's see. So after some years of working as a part-time staff person for the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America as a grassroots organizer, and then a couple of years off as a freelance writer, starving artist, I was invited to apply for a job with the World Council of Churches Ecumenical Accompaniment Program in Palestine and Israel. It's a mouthful. It's one of the, it's almost as hard to say as the Center for Global Education at Augsburg College, maybe harder. But it's important, every element in that set of initials has an important feature. So I've been with this job now since December as U.S. coordinator for the EAPPI, and it's a real privilege. It's also a real challenge, because volunteering, I don't know how many of you have ever volunteered abroad or know somebody who has. I've always wanted to, but just when I got eligible, my husband's a heart patient, and it's kind of, I don't want to leave him for 3 months at a time, really, so I can't do this myself. But the EAPPI is one example of a trend, a kind of a global trend, particularly in the churches, but also in the secular world, to accommodate people's desire to volunteer, increasing desire to volunteer, especially among two groups, youth, your young people, and seniors. Those are the people who have either the time or the money, or hopefully both, to be able to volunteer. And this is a program that the World Council of Churches developed partly in response to that, but primarily in response to a word that came from the churches of Jerusalem. There's a group, a council called the Jerusalem Heads of Churches. And in 2002, or 2001, they issued basically a call to the Christian churches of the world to come and be with us, come and walk with us. We are too alone here in Jerusalem and the West Bank, too isolated, too far from the media's attention. It's too easy to be abused when no one's watching. And the World Council of Churches, which is, you know, a great international body that includes most of the mainline churches of the U.S. and then many, many world churches, and including most of the Orthodox churches, formulated this program called the EAPPI in response to that call from the heads of Jerusalem churches. So EAPPI, here's the website, stands for Ecumenical Accompaniment Program in Palestine and Israel. It's ecumenical because it includes participants from so many different Christian churches, and actually there have been Muslim volunteers and Jewish volunteers and people with no particular religion. It's not, you don't have to go as a religious person, that's not the point. The point is that this religious body is sponsoring the presence of volunteers in the region. And then it's accompaniment, which is a principle I came into contact with in my time working at the ELCA. Boy, I don't know if all churches were doing this at about the same time in the 90s, but coming up with the principle of accompaniment instead of mission. We still call it global mission, but the principle of sending missionaries whose job is just to serve, which is great, but serving and kind of a well, what's been perceived as sort of a patronizing construct. It kind of started to give way to this other idea of accompaniment, and the ELCA went full bore with it. They've written whole theological papers on this principle of accompaniment, which is we will come if you ask us to come and be with you. We'll come and be with you. We'll see what your needs are before we charge in and tell you what you need. Sound familiar, Jerry?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And but this was really new 15 or so years ago. And we still hear about it in the ELCA. Well, you don't send any missionaries anymore. But of course we do. It's just they serve in different ways. But this kind of accompaniment is even a step beyond what missionaries do, because, well, I sometimes say, we don't build clinics, we don't do puppet shows. We walk with the people in their daily life, in solidarity with them, arm in arm. And the model is the same as that of the ELCA, the Emmaus Road, where the people walked along not knowing that the person they walked with was Jesus. And so which one is Jesus, I don't know, but we walk together side by side. And especially in Palestine, in the West Bank, where they're so the problems are so insurmountable that building projects and aren't all that helpful. What is helpful is a witness, someone who's there, who sees what's happening, who records what's happening, someone who wears a vest that says, I'm with an international organization. EAPPI isn't the only one, but it's one that's recognized. It's recognized by the soldiers, very important, and it's recognized by the police and by the settlers as an international organization. These aren't just vulnerable Palestinians here. There's an international presence, someone with a video camera, someone with a notebook, someone's watching and walking arm in arm with these people. And so from that witnessing perspective, most of our volunteers keep a blog, and you can find those blogs at the same webpage. And you know, they have a fascinating experience, sometimes kind of dark, and other times very, enhancing their life and a real growing, happy experience. So I'll probably come back to accompaniment, but I want to be sure to include, this first P is for program, so there's nothing too exciting about that, but the thing I think is funny is it's, here in the U.S., it looks like it's spelled wrong. That's because it's spelled the European way, with two M's and an E. So, but it's not up to me to change it. Then the P and I at the end, Palestine and Israel. These initials are important because first, the P for Palestine indicates that the World Council of Churches recognizes Palestine as a people. It's not a nation state, but it's a cultural group. It's a people who desire and deserve a nation, and they get to be called what they want to be called, which is Palestine. In other parts of the world, you'll hear this region that looks like this, the green part and the yellow part, described as the occupied Palestinian lands or the occupied territories or the West Bank. What they really want to be called is Palestine. And so that's what the World Council calls them. And then the last letter is I for Israel. And that's because we also walk in solidarity with those Israelis who are committed to peace and justice and who are working on human rights. And all the folks from the peace movement, many times the international witnesses from the different groups will march in the various protest marches in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem with the Israeli peace bloc. We also have a team always assigned to Jerusalem, and those are the folks that most often take visiting groups around to meet with members of the Israeli peace groups, the human rights agencies, the UN, all the people that also need someone to be with them in solidarity, because they are have undertaken a tough thing, an unpopular thing in their own country. So that's the group I work for, but it's not the only one. As I said, there are a couple of others. There are a couple of others that are the best known in Palestine. One is the Christian Peacemaker Teams, which I'm sure many of you have heard of. Christian Peacemaker Teams originated in the Mennonites, and right now we are in conversation with the different peace churches. That would be the Mennonites, the Friends, the Church of the Brethren, because what they're doing with Christian Peacemaker Teams is very similar to what World Council of Churches is doing with EAPPI. So we're looking for ways we can support one another. Right now it's just sort of on the ground, informal, but maybe there's ways. If there are people who are Mennonites or Church of the Brethren folks, they will tend toward Christian Peacemaker Teams because that's the organization that their group initiated. Part of the difference is that those folks have to make a commitment to, I think, a year to 3 years. And in EAPPI, the commitment is only 3 months. So it's, you know, it's different. And that's okay. Both are needed. So there are a lot of people that can't go for a year or two, but could go for 3 months. They sometimes work in some of the same settings, but often they try to parse it out, and so that if you're here, if you've got a team in this town, then we don't need to be there because we know you've got it covered. So they're not competitive. They're friendly. Everybody's working on the same team. Another group is called International Solidarity Movement, also known as ISM. And International Solidarity Movement is not church-based. It came out of the Palestinian community as a way to use nonviolent direct action methods to oppose the occupation. And they really try to get in the way. They have a different aspect. They're more they're committed to nonviolence, but they are about direct action, and that can't be said of EAPPI. Someone told me an analogy for these three. They're all friends. They all work together. As a matter of fact, when I worked for ELCA, starting up this before we had blogs, we had email lists, and I would send out messages. And sometimes I would get these messages about the International Solidarity Movement volunteers, and their stories were so profound and so good. But I worked for the ELCA, and I couldn't find an ELCA connection. I would look for it, and I couldn't find it. But all the ELCA people in the region seemed to know these folks and approve of them, and so I just struggled with it. And finally, I asked the pastor at Redeemer Lutheran Church in the Old City, Jerusalem, you know, how can I, what's your relationship with these ISM volunteers? Because they're doing great work, but I can't say anything about them on the ELCA webpage because I don't find the link. He said, well, here's the link for you. They all worship at our church. So I said, oh, okay, yeah, I can do that. That's great. So it was an informal link, but it was there. International Solidarity Movement is the group that really got a lot of attention when Rachel Corrie was killed in Gaza. She was with the ISM, and she was taking the kind of action that they do take, which is she was wearing blaze orange, and she was standing in front of a bulldozer and with a bullhorn, and somehow the driver claims he didn't see her, but anyway, she was run over by that bulldozer and killed in Rafah, in Gaza. So that brought International Solidarity Movement a lot into the public eye. She was from Oregon, I think, and went to Evergreen. I can't remember what town she was from. Anyway, now the EAPPI does not get in that kind of dangerous situation. I'd say one of the kind of the selling points as I'm trying to recruit volunteers for EAPPI is that it's safe. It is a very conservative program, and that's by design, so that we can freely encourage church members to take part in it and not be putting them in danger. The metaphor somebody used one time when I said, it was my predecessor, I said, tell me about the different groups and how are they different? Well, he said, if we go to a protest march in Tel Aviv, the International Solidarity will be with all the peaceniks from the Israeli peace groups, but they have march in groups, you know, in kind of phalanxes. He said the International Solidarity Movement folks will be up way up toward the front, and they'll have big signs and bullhorns, and they'll be wearing their blaze orange coats. And then a few more groups will go by, and then in the middle of the parade will be the Christian peacemaker teams, and they'll have their vests on and smaller signs and no bullhorns. And then toward the back of the middle will be the EAPPI volunteers who'll be wearing their khaki-colored vests, no signs, and no bullhorns. Which is, I mean, that helped me understand, yes, this is a conservative program that puts a lot of emphasis on safety, and that's fine. I can use that. But they're all friends, and they all work together in the region. There are a couple of other programs that I don't want to leave out because they're also very good, and there are ways to, if anyone's thinking about this or if you know someone who might consider a program like this, there are just so many options that if one doesn't work, another one might. For example, in the ELCA, there's the Boominous program in probably the whole church is Young Adults and Global Ministries. And that program expanded last year for the first time to include, I think, 9 or 12 placements in Jerusalem and the West Bank. And that's very exciting because that allows young people from my church to go and volunteer in a way that they can't with my program, because for EAPPI, you've got to be 25. And a lot of people, young people, are ready to volunteer at 22. And so ELCA has this new program. Now the second group has just left a couple of weeks ago, and I'm really pleased to know a couple of them. One in particular, Greta Stieber, was on the staff up here. So that's for young people. Then there's a really fine program the Methodists have, if you are a Methodist or know any Methodists, called Volunteers in Mission. And a number of people in the from the Methodist Church have very important positions. It's not like a big group. They go in ones and twos. They get special assignments to a special place where there's a real need that meets their... They're like a missionary, except they're volunteers. And there was a volunteer in mission for a number of years in Bethlehem working with Pastor Rahib at Christmas Lutheran Church, who was an ELCA pastor. But she went through the Methodist system. And there's a woman named Lisa Caldwell, who's a VIM. She writes a very powerful blog and sends messages regularly from her experience, and then the others. So there also are ways that a person can finagle their own, kind of custom-built experience. I know of people who have gone to work at Augusta Victoria Hospital, medical professionals who put in a few months working at the Lutheran Hospital in Jerusalem, very important medical facility for the West Bank community. It's the only place that provides pediatric kidney dialysis for the whole West Bank, as adult dialysis, and also is the only place for radiation therapy for cancer treatment. So, yes?
Is that hospital able to be utilized now by the Israelis since it's in the Palestine area of Jerusalem?
It would certainly be open to Israelis.
Are they able to get through the walls?
You mean which mainly serves the Palestinian community. Actually, when we were there a few years ago, our tour guide, who was we were with the Israel Committee Against Home Demolition, so it was this Argentinian Jewish woman who really didn't know anything about Lutherans, and as we went by, she said, let me point out to you here in the hill, this is the refugee hospital. It's a very fine hospital. I thought, that's cool. Our hospital, ours, I say, it's run by the Lutheran World Federation, is known as the refugee hospital. And it was a great service to refugees after the wars. But like most Israelis would go to Hadassah Hospital or to an Israeli hospital. The Augusta Victoria Hospital serves mostly Palestinians who would have... Palestinians are also served by the Israeli hospitals, but it would be a lot harder for them to get there. And the wall does come in between the people and the hospital. Well, see, I think I can show you on this map a little bit. This red line and this zigzaggy kind of peppermint line... This is the wall as it was being built in 2004 when this map was made by the UN. And so there are also several major checkpoints in this area, all surrounding Jerusalem. So people coming from out here in the suburbs would have to get to one of the gates, one of the checkpoints, and get through the wall. It's possible, but what's really difficult is for the staff, this is a little riff that doesn't really belong in this session, but it became so difficult several years ago for the staff to get to and from work with all the checkpoints and the wall going up that the director of the hospital, really great guy named Tawfiq Nasser, he took the attic of the rafters, the attic of the hospital, and turned it into a dorm, put beds and wardrobes up there so that his staff could spend the night, which they had to do way too many times since they couldn't get home. Or if they got home, they wouldn't be able to get to work in the morning with the jam-ups at the hospital, the checkpoints. And then they've also developed a little mobile, little bus that'll go around and pick up patients and bring them in, and they get us passed because Dr. Nasser is really good at work in the system. So he's got some passes that allow him to go out and get some of these cancer patients and these dialysis patients in the little shuttle bus. Of course, they shouldn't have to do that, right? But they do. Well, so that's one place I know some folks have volunteered. Others have volunteered at the Dar al-Kalama school in Bethlehem, just kind of on their own, or worked out a plan to volunteer in one of the churches. The Anglicans also have a church program, and I don't know how they organize their volunteers, but they have a school, a very fine school in Jerusalem called St. George's, and they have an extremely important, and I wanted to mention this last night in the sermon, so I'm going to say it now, they have such an important hospital in Gaza City. It's called the Ali Arab Hospital. I mean, compared to Augusta Victoria, it's like a MASH unit. It's really poor, and yet they try to do so much. They have to serve so many people who are injured in Gaza at this little... I mean, this hospital isn't as big as Koinonia, I don't think. And yet they're crucial without the doctors and nurses at the Ali Arab Hospital. And that's an Anglican ministry, or Episcopalian, we'd say. So those are some of the different kinds of projects that are out there. Let me stop a minute and see if there's any questions. Well, I'll tell you a few examples of how this works on the ground with the accompaniers. For example, the EAPPI has 6 sites where they're located. I wonder if I can find them all on this map. One is in this Palestinian city of Tulkarm. One is in Jerusalem, like I said. One is down here in Hebron, which is a really special case. One is in Bethlehem. How many have I done? 4?
4.
One is, do you see Kalkilia? In here, right about, See how it likes is like a kind of like a nipple or something that sticks out here? That's because Qalqilya, which is an important Palestinian city, is completely surrounded on all four sides by the wall. So it's not like the wall is just running along the border here. It's in here. And then it wraps around Qalqilya all the way around, like ties it in a knot, and then comes out the other side. So this is a very, very difficult place. And there's this little town called Jayus right here, just to the east of Qalqilya. And there are lots and lots of Israeli settlements all around here. So that's why the wall goes where it does. The wall goes into the West Bank to scoop up real estate wherever the settlements are and lasso them in. But the people are trapped, the people that live on the other side, the Palestinian people, because they can't go to Israel, and then now they can't go to Palestine either. They're in a no man's land. They have a really hard life. And then there's another group at a little town not far from Nablus, out in the country though, called Yanun. And that's a really remote setting. That's the most remote of all the EAPPI placements. And that's a little village that is, it's a not a city, it's a village. But it had some lands, it had some grazing land, it had some olive groves, it had some farm land. And it's that little village is almost completely surrounded by settlements, which are these Israeli cities that they've built way over here by Nablus. And so those folks, and they're, this particular community of settlers are very hostile and, violent. So they often will maraud in through the village and break things and break windows and spray graffiti and sometimes start fires and beat people up. And there's really, the Israelis don't have, it's their responsibility to protect the Palestinians, but they don't have a full-time squad there protecting them from these settlers. So it's a little bit like High Noon or, you know, the Wild West or someplace where the forces of violence just come marauding into town. And so there's an EAPPI group there at Yanun too.
Mm-hmm. And why don't we ever hear about that? I mean, from you, we know.
Well, it's a little, I don't know, in the big picture, it's a little piece of news, but some things make the news, like a guy, I'm not trying to scare you, but a guy from the Christian Peacemaker team last fall, December, was shot by Israelis' army. Now they've got a new thing, and they shoot these, they have the rubber bullets, you know, which aren't really rubber, they're really bullets that are covered with rubber. But now they have these tear gas canisters. They used to have to shoot a tear gas canister out of a little launcher. And of course, the idea is to send it into a building and drive all the people out, or into a crowd and make them disperse. But now, I don't know what company has developed these tear gas canisters, probably about the size of this glass, they have them on a little rifle launcher, like a little assault rifle. So instead of having to set them up and, you know, launch them in the general direction of a crowd that they want to disperse, they can aim them right at somebody and do. And so in this case, this was near a nonviolent protest against the wall, and a member of the CPT who was not in the demonstration, he'd moved to the side with some media people standing off to the side. Anyway, he got shot right in the face with one of these tear gas canisters, and he's very badly injured still. He's probably will be brain damaged. And that made quite a bit of news, at least if you're reading and going, like when my New York Times comes up every morning, it's coming up to the page with Foreign Affairs. So that's the first page. If I want to read the stuff about the stock market, I have to click way back in the New York Times and come at it another way, because the foreign news is the first thing I get. there are lots of ways, and I could talk about the media too. There are alternative news sources, and one of the best is Haaretz, which is an Israeli, kind of a mainstream newspaper, and they have an excellent website. And let's see, haaretz.com. They're not particularly left wing, but they're not right wing either, which is, so they're a fairly good mainstream kind of left leaning source right out of Israel. There are all kinds of indie, they're called indie, I had to learn this, news sources out coming out of Palestine. They're not always as careful with their journalism. I'm a journalism major, so I'm still, even after all these years, touchy about sources and accountability. So I look real hard at news reports coming from independent sources that I am not sure about. But if you start looking under indie media, you'll find lots of sources from Palestine.
Is that H-A-A-R?
H-A-A-R-E-T-Z. It's in Israel it would have a apostrophe between the A's, Haaretz. Mm-hmm. And they have, there's one columnist and reporter for Haaretz that has really gone out on a limb. She's quite wonderful. Her name is Amira Haas. And she has written a book, she's written a book about Gaza. She's written a number of books, and they haven't thrown her off the staff. She's very, very critical of Israeli policy at almost every turn, which is very, very fine. If you get a chance to Google her or look up her books, she's excellent. And she's an Israeli, very, very critical.
What was her name again?
Amira Haas, H-A-A-S. Where's my marker?
And there is one group that I heard about that's fairly conservative that, and I don't know their name, I was going to ask if you knew it. Then they just decided to start putting the same textbooks in the Israeli and in the Palestinian high schools who would accept them.
Wow.
So that they were reading the same history books.
That's so interesting. I just read an article last week before I came up here about the textbook squabble. And it'd be interesting who would accept those textbooks.
They're not very many, but they keep on valiantly, and they said kids going to school together outside Israel and Palestine, if they could is happening. Are not say Israel, but to just have Palestinian and Israeli kids, as many of them as will accept them, read the same textbook.
Right. This is something I often hear about, because both sides, this is like the two worlds thing, Earth versus Moon or something. Neither side recognizes the other's experiences in their textbooks. So, as you pointed out, Trish, kids grow up and they have heard their own narrative from their own perspective. I mean, this happens in our textbooks too, but not to such an extreme degree that the maps are, not true, for example. And also in the Palestinian textbooks, there are flaws in the, and there is a bias. It's acknowledged, everybody knows it. But this article, I think I tossed it in recycling. Anyway, it was from an Israeli commentator, and he was critiquing the two sets of textbooks, and he came up with quite a few more things, not full truth, or kind of in the Israeli textbooks, so that's too bad. Well, I'll give you an example.
About it not happening here. One classic example that maybe some of you besides me are old enough to remember is in movies before World War II, the Indians were never the good guys. I mean, and even slightly after World War II, there was never a movie with Indians being the good guys.
Well, I just remember as a kid, I mean, I'm still mad about it, you know, and aside, commentary aside, that, you know, we weren't told the truth about the Vietnam War, which was underway, and you know, kids from our school were being drafted, and we weren't being told the truth. So you could ask your teachers and you could ask your parents, but they wouldn't give you the straight story, no. Or they didn't know it.
What about the current war?
Sorry?
War in
Iraq? Yeah, the current war, we're just as baffled by. I got these old maps, so I thought I'd get rid of them. I'm going to pass these around and give them to you just because I have so many, and otherwise they're going in recycling. They show some of the divisions, and why not? Just if you don't want it, leave it behind, and I'll put it in recycling. But I don't want to run out of time to tell a couple of stories about how these volunteers, accompaniers work. We visited, Franz and I visited Jayus, which is, as I said, up near Kalkilia. And if you have time, I know you can't see it from here, but if you have time later, stop and look at this map, because it shows in red how Kalkilia is completely surrounded by the wall. Mm-hmm. And then the neighboring towns are cut off from their fields and vineyards. And here's what they do. It's not a wall up there, it's a fence. It's a highway. That's a military highway. Nobody has no use other than for military vehicles. Then there's wire on either side. And then there's another set of wire. And at that outside set of wire are gates. And it's electric, but it's not electric. It doesn't electrocute you. This is often misunderstood about the wall or the fence. It's an electric wire that calls the military who come on their special road. It's not the kind of electric wire that will, it's not always the kind that will shock you, but sometimes it is. But it will always call the army who will come then with their jeep on their, or whatever, on their special road. It's just for them that goes along this route. So, you know, here you've got a village, and you know, in the way that they do things, they have their fields out beyond the village. Everybody lives together in their houses in here, and then out here are their surrounding lands, and they would walk or take a pickup, just like we would, you know, out to where they're. In the case of the farmer we met at Jayus, he had greenhouses, he had olive trees, he had his wells all out, you know, beyond the town in the surrounding countryside. That's how they do it there. And then when the fence was put in, and then way over there beyond the hill, you can see it very easily, is the new Israeli city that has been built there. Called a settlement. And so then here's the wall, their security fence rather, and instead of building, like the whole argument they have is that, oh, we have to build this security wall / fence to protect our citizens who are living in these new cities we've built. But they didn't put this fence right next to the settlement. They put this fence way over here next to the village. So you know, am I the only one that sees, I can't be the only one that sees this as a land grab. This is what this is about. And so on the other side of the fence, with the four layers of fence and the highway and the military guy, are all these farmers' lands. And this one guy, I mean, they're not like peasants. This guy was a fairly prosperous farmer. He had 8 or 10 greenhouses out there where he was growing flowers and vegetables, and then he had his olive groves and, you know, his thing, farm thing going there, and his wells. And now we can't reach any of them. And he's just one guy, and the whole town is in the same fix. He was the person who we had tea with and welcomed us up to the roof of his house to point out how things used to be. And then we went down, we were the guests of the EAPPI volunteers and these farmers. I was with a group from the ELCA. So we walked down to the fence gate where they would normally be let through, and they showed us how it works. What happens is every morning the EAPPI accompanier, or a couple of them, walks with the farmers down to the gate, and then the military jeep comes. It's supposed to be on a particular schedule. If it's not, the EAPPI folks call and say, hey, you're supposed to have somebody here to open this gate. And then they open it, then they go to the other side, open it again, then they Palestinian farmers and people can go through, and then they close the gate behind them. Now they're on the other side, and they have to stay there all day. So they have to bring water and lunch and everything. And then later in the evening, early evening or late afternoon, they come back through. They get permission from, they get the soldiers to come and let them through again. So the one thing the EAPPI folks do is they go with them on this project every day to make sure that it happens on time, to make sure that no one's bothering them, to make sure that they're safe there. Now sometimes they go along into the farmlands and take pictures and help them. One of the problems is that with, like for example, harvesting olives, for example, it's a huge Palestinian cultural tradition. I mean, I can't think of anything we've got that's quite like it. The olive tree is so sacred in Palestinian culture, and the olives, when they're harvested, it's a big family affair. You know, everybody gets out of school, and people come and help. You know, sisters and brothers come from out of town, and everyone helps with the olive harvest. And it's very labor intensive.
And ricing is in Minnesota with the.
Oh yes, ricing, of course.
It's everyone comes home mm-hmm. for ricing. Mm-hmm.
You're right. I hadn't thought of that. So, but now with the fence the way it is, and in Jais and many other communities just like them, what the army will let, the soldiers will let one, like the owner, he can get permission to go through the fence because he can prove that he's the owner. So according to the Israelis, he has the right to cross through the gate and go to the other side and work over there. But when it's harvest time, he can't harvest that whole olive crop himself. And normally they would also hire workers. And now he's not permitted to hire anyone. He can't bring anybody with him. So the olive crop just goes to pot many times. So sometimes the EAs go and the accompaniers go and help with the harvest. Or sometimes they can bargain with the soldiers and get them to let more people through to help with the harvest. But according to the law, they're only required to let the owner of the land go through. Meanwhile, what's been documented by the accompaniers in that region is, because they're watching, they're witnessing, they've got cameras, they've got binoculars, is the trucks coming from the other side, from the city, the new Israeli city. They come into the land, and they've got these big tree harvesters that you've seen rolling down the highway, you know, with one or two trees on the back. They've got like a sort of a cone-shaped blade thing. And they pick up those olive trees, and away they go. You see them in the expensive landscapers in Tel Aviv or in the settlements. They put them in the Meridian. They just steal them. And there's nothing to be done about it except to document it, try to publicize it. I mean, here, an olive tree, what is it worth, you know? It doesn't make the news, you're right, but there is everything. And plus, it's such a sacred symbol for them. So those are the folks in some of the things they do in Jaius. In Hebron, down here, it's completely surrounded by the wall and very complicated setting, because Hebron is an ancient Palestinian city, an ancient Arab city, and with a holy shrine that was sacred to both Jews and Muslims, the tomb of Abraham and Sarah. And so for a long time, pilgrims have made the journey to Hebron, Christians, Jews, and Muslims in peace. There was a there was a bad spate of violence in the 1920s there, and some Jewish pilgrims were killed. There was a lot of violence in the 1920s between Arabs and Jews. But it was a majority Arab city, a majority Palestinian city, almost no Jews lived there. It was in the same category with Nablus and Jenin and these other Arab cities. But a group of settlers, and these happened to not be the ones who were getting a townhouse with a federal subsidy. These were the fanatical, religious fanatics, moved into some block of houses and apartments right in the middle of Hebron and started a settlement, a colony, right in the middle of town. And immediately they brought in them. It was very strategically planned. It was planned like a military operation. They came in the night, they took over these homes, then more people came in, then they just threw out the Arab neighbors in the adjoining homes, just literally threw them out, took over these homes by force, and declared themselves a settlement. And that's been, Israel sent in soldiers to protect them. You'd think they'd send in soldiers to throw them out, but they sent in soldiers to protect them, and that settlement has been growing and growing over the years. So the whole city is divided up. I'm sorry, Karen, did you get me some water? The whole city is divided and barricaded, and the people that were originally there, the Hebronites, can only go through these certain corridors by on foot or by car, and then there are whole areas that are reserved for Israelis transit in and out of the city with their special protected roads and no-go zones because of this insane colony religious fanatics in the middle of a city that they have no business in. There are both Christian Peacemaker teams and EAPPI volunteers in Hebron. In part, watching what's going on and making reports and some simple things that are actually kind of hazardous, like walking the children to school. One of the things in Hebron that sticks out is that because the settlers own certain blocks of homes, they throw things down on people that are walking below. They're really obnoxious people. You may have seen some of them interviewed on TV. They're fanatics. They throw garbage, they throw human waste, they throw any kind of terrible schmutz can come down from above. So they've had to put like netting over all the pedestrian walkways in that area to protect people that are walking below from the things that are thrown from above. And they're not, you could get hurt. They're bottles and bottles with liquid inside, heavy, then they can hurt you. And so they've put up netting to try to protect pedestrians. Another thing that has resulted is that the children have to walk from their homes to their schools, have to walk through a really unfriendly area. Especially there's a bunch of little girls that have to walk to they attend a school that's about, looks like about a half a mile away, and they would normally walk. And they've had to take a kind of a different route now because of the neighborhoods being divided and the hostility that they experience. But these are little kids. These are like our little Holden kids going to school. They're not the opposition, except they are, just by nature of who they are. So there's a bunch of bigger kids, like middle school kids, who are kind of trained by their by their settler parents to harass these little kids, to push them down, throw things at them, throw rocks at them, scare them. And so the EAs and the Christian Peacemaker teams, people alternate with shepherding these kids to their school and back, just walking along with them, like they're like a little bunch of ducklings. And even so, these these Israeli settlers will come out and throw things right at the volunteers too. They'll throw rocks at them. They'll run up and try to punch them or beat them with a stick or knock them over. It's just insane. Hebron is very special, very sad place, but a very beautiful place. So if you go to the region, be sure to visit. The mosque is so lovely. It's all green tile inside and so pretty. Green, and gold. Then there's a story from the checkpoint that's pretty telling. Here Bethlehem is, and this it's even worse now than it was in 2004. Here you see the red. And the way it's looping around here, trying to snag all these brown settlements. And here's Bethlehem, and here's Jerusalem. These two, very close. You could usually make it. I mean, you could hike, you could ride your bike easily between Bethlehem and Jerusalem in 45 minutes probably. Drive it in, 20 minutes at most. But now with all these settlements, traffic is much, much worse, for one thing. And again, here's the green line. Here's Israel. Here's Palestine. The wall is not being built on the green line. It's built way over here, scooping up all this land down here and around here. So there are several important checkpoints between Bethlehem and any place else. And these are really dehumanizing, especially they built a great big new, they call it the terminal between one of the major checkpoint here. And everyone has to get out of their car, go into a processing kind of waiting area where they're watched from up above like this. I mean, it's like a prison. And then they can go out the other end one at a time through one of these, have you ever seen in the subway, sometimes they'll have these things you walk through, click. Only one person can go through at a time.
Right.
And here's, hundreds of people commuting, trying to get to their job, trying to get to their, they're not necessarily trying to go to Jerusalem, they're just trying to get out of Bethlehem and go someplace else. And on the other side of this whole processing center, that's what they call it, the terminal, then there's a bank of taxis waiting, because they've had to leave their other car on the other side. You have to go through as a pedestrian. So naturally, there are long lines. And often in the hot, hot sun, nobody gets a break. Old people, mothers with babies, pregnant mothers, kids, everyone has to go through the same system. It's completely inhuman. But one of the things that we heard a story about this from, I heard from one of my volunteers who had spent time out in the villages out here, outside Bethlehem. One of their tasks was to go around and, visit and get acquainted. And her companion for this was a young person from Scandinavia, I think, and this EA was like a middle-aged Lutheran pastor from here. And she said, her companion was kind of grousing, like, why do we have to go and visit these? What's with all the visiting, We should be doing something else. This sitting around drinking tea with people and getting to know them. Just kind of chafing under it. I guess she was younger and wanted to be more active. Pastor Pat Woods is her name. She was told about a time that they were approaching the checkpoint, because one of the things they don't do is checkpoint monitoring. They go to the checkpoints, the Palestinian side, and they just keep an eye on things, and they take notes and take video or take pictures if they need to, and visit with people and hear about their experiences, and mainly keep an eye on things and let the Israeli soldiers know that there's some internationals here. These folks, these 100 people that are waiting are not alone. They have somebody who's on their side. And that sends a message. So as they arrived for their couple hours they were going to spend there, they saw that the Israelis had a young man who was pinned down, and they were beating him up, and he was flailing about, and the people in the line were really agitated, and they said, what's happening? What's going on? And they said, oh, this young man, he shouldn't be here. He's mentally ill. He must have wandered off. Someone should be watching him, but they weren't, and now he's here, and he said something inappropriate to the soldiers, and now, he's in terrible trouble here, and we don't know what to do. So the Pat Woods, we call him EA, is the accompanier. She said, well, where is he from? Where is he from? And they said, well, he's from one of these, they named this little village. Right away she said, I know people in that village. So she pulled out her cell phone, made a few calls, called the head man in that little village. Within 10 minutes, they are coming up in a car to find their lost boy and try to persuade the Israelis to give him up. Of course, by that time, he'd been taken off to some other more terrible holding place. But at least they were able to put it together and locate, okay, this kid belongs with these people. And they made the match. And I like that story because it shows the value of going around visiting towns that didn't seem that interesting until all of a sudden you needed to know, here's a acutely vulnerable person who needs help. And they were able to make the call, get the help on the way. But I really like that story. Well, I've kind of covered the ground I wanted to cover. If you are, yes, Martha.
The Israelis don't have any problem with them taking pictures. They don't confiscate their cameras or anything like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, they do. Sometimes they okay. do. So they download their pictures every day. Okay. For example. One thing is, if you're traveling Israel, you don't take pictures of soldiers, if you can avoid it. You don't get caught taking pictures of soldiers because they don't like that. But they don't care if you're taking pictures of the people and their circumstances. They might not care. Sometimes they will. They've had cameras confiscated. But sometimes they'll just say, look, I'll just take out my SIM card. Take it. And then leave me the camera. Depends on what kind of mood the soldier's in. Soldiers, you got to figure, 19 years old. Maybe 20, but probably young. This is the only setting he or she has ever seen Palestinians in, the setting of them being cattle and the soldiers being required to guard them, which they find really boring and tedious, and they get angry about it. So they can be in a bad mood, take the camera, throw it against the rocks, but lots of times they're content to just take out the SIM card and say, well, we have to have this for security. But the staff, the accompaniers, take precautions. So I have lots of brochures for the Ecumenical Accompaniment Program. If you are interested in learning more, if you know somebody, if you yourself think you might be interested in this a couple years from now or now, or I'm always available. My name's on the back of each one, my email address. Don't take them if you're just going to throw them away, but if you're interested and you want to learn more or you want to take some to your church, I'd be more than happy to let you take as many as you want of these. And I thank you very much for being here. I think it's time to close. Let's close with prayer. The Lord be with you. Thank you, God, for the day you've given us, for the opportunity to share the stories of these witnesses. It's been my joy. Thank you for the presence of the faithful in every place, trying to manifest your justice and peace in settings that are pretty hard. We know you're with them and you love them and the people they protect. Be with us now as we approach worship. and bless us always. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.